This is perhaps the moment we've been waiting for, at least that according to our next guest, media theorist Douglas Rushkoff. He says, we don't seem to have any time in which to live it, though. Instead, we remain poised and frozen, overwhelmed by an always-on live-streamed reality that our human bodies and minds can never truly inhabit. And our failure to do so had wide-ranging effects on every aspect of our lives, according to Rushkoff. He says the future has arrived. We live in a continuous now enabled by Twitter, email, and so-called real-time technological shifts. Yet this now is an elusive goal that we can never quite reach. And the dissonance between our digital selves and our analog bodies has thrown us into a new state of anxiety, something he calls present shock. Douglas Rushkoff brings together seemingly disparate events and trends into this portrait of how life in the eternal present has affected our biology, our behavior, our politics, and culture. Again, the name of the book is Present Shock, When Everything Happens Now. It's a pleasure to welcome Douglas Rushkoff to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Hi, great to be with you.
It is a delight to have you on the program. When we talk about these issues of the way that you portray this, of everything happening now and putting us into some form of shock, what was the breaking point for you of saying, this is something that I need to explore, this is something I need to look at and explain?
Well, I guess for me it was two different things. I mean, one was when I was sitting in the lobby of a hotel in Berlin on the wrong time zone and unable to check into my room, and I was trying to get on Google Calendar to find out if I could schedule something back at home, and I'd been trying to log in from so many different places that my Google Calendar said, you appear to be logging in from too many places at once, you know, therefore you seem to be a security risk and we're going to shut you out. In other words, Google did not believe that I was even human, because I was coming at it from so many different places at once. So I realized that, and I ended up double scheduling that day and getting in all this trouble, that somehow I had allowed my digital lives, all the various things I have going on, and you know, between my Facebook feed and my Twitter feed and my email address and all this, I had so many different me's kind of colliding for room in the same calendar, and I realized my time was getting broken up in a way that I was no longer comfortable. And then as I looked at the rest of my life and our culture, I started to see it less as, oh, just a scheduling thing, and really more as a tendency to kind of break ourselves up into all of these little inconsistent pieces and to chase what we think is the current moment, whether we're chasing the Twitter feed or chasing the Google Now and trying to keep up with what's happening, when what's actually happening is right with us all the time.
You make that point, which is really a fascinating one, is that we are often paced by our technologies, but as you point out in the book, we can just as easily program our technologies to follow our paces. So it isn't the tail wagging the dog.
Right. And I think the real problem here is that, you know, these technologies came along, and originally, you know, digital technologies gave us all the time in the world. You know, people who were involved in the internet in the late 80s or early 90s, the thing that we always kept remarking was how intelligent we sounded online, because online you didn't have to respond in real time or immediately to a conversation. You downloaded a conversation and you read it and you thought for hours or even overnight how you were going to respond, and everybody sounded, you know, like, you know, William Buckley or Christopher Hitchens or somebody, you know, as compared to now when we try to use the internet in real time, you know, and we fasten devices to ourselves or keep our phones vibrating so that we can respond the instant a text or an email comes in, and we sound much, much less intelligent online than we do in real life, because we're not really exploiting this digital age ability to do things in our own time, the same way we can watch Netflix in our own time or watch a television show in our own time. We can respond to this stuff in our own time as well.
Does this all basically come down to the cell phone? I mean, it seems that so much of the technology that you talk about in the book and so many of the examples that you give really do come out of that, that we have this device that, as you say, is attached to us.
For individual humans, you know, a lot of it is surely in there. Certainly the digital aspect of this presentism, of living in this constant now, a lot of it definitely comes from there. But then in the bigger sense, it's also just sort of what happened to us as we moved from the 1900s into the 2000s, from a very speculative, forward-leaning, almost millennial culture. Then, you know, Y2K happened and the planes didn't fall from the sky. You know, we got to the 21st century and people stopped looking forward so much. You know, futurism became less prevalent. The next big thing became less important to people than, you know, what's happening right now? What are my stocks actually worth? What's my connection with my family? You know, people stopped leaning forward. And I feel like as a society, we stopped leaning forward so much and really moved into something much more like the present.
So what do we lose by not looking forward? Because some would argue that we were looking forward too much, not worried about what was happening in the now.
Right. I mean, what you lose by not looking forward, it in some cases is good, but what we lose is the ability to sort of motivate people towards big common goals and agendas. You know, we end up, like in politics, responding to every little budget crisis every month or two because we can't really set a goal that we can agree on and move towards it. We don't really have movements, you know, like the great 20th century, you know, civil rights movement and the women's movement. It's very hard to motivate, especially young people, towards these sort of sweeping narrative goals. You know, on the other hand, that's a good thing because most of those goals turn out to be illusory. Most of the time, people who have a dream and are trying to get you to march with them towards some goal, you know, usually they have an agenda, and usually, you know, the ends don't justify the means that you've used to get there. So the sort of the cultural impact of all this, of all this presentism, is a really a widespread inability to deal with the kinds of problems we have today, which are less sort of big goal-oriented problems. They're more about, you know, how do we have a sustainable economy? How do we deal with the environment? How do we deal with world hunger? These kind of more, you know, chronic type problems that don't have these grand victories, you know, that if we do solve them, it's going to be a lot more subtle than sticking a flag in the surface of the moon and declaring it ours.
Let me focus in on two words that you just spoke of, and that is all this. And I think that's fascinating because we think of all this is really stuff. There's so much there. And if there's any example I can think of to try to put this into an intelligent question for you, is you look at a 24-hour news cycle, and with CNN and Fox and MSNBC and all of these news stations, they give us more and more and more, and we have this 24/7 news cycle. Yet we find that people are know less about the issues. They have that has not certainly given us more information. It has not made us smarter about issues because there's a regurgitation of it, and it has also become very polarized as well. So we use that. I take that as an example, and then give it to you on the plate of okay, of all this technology and all this that puts us into the moment. I mean, is there a point that we're swamped? There's too many tubes of toothpaste on the shelf, and we don't know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny with information, certainly news information. You know, CNN definitely destabilized the whole system. But then it sort of, instead of just doing what they do best, you know, which is the network news, sort of the evening news show that kind of ties things together, you know, they tried to compete with CNN for the newest news, you know, and it's like if it's not new and different, then we're not going to talk about it. But when you turn it on, it's just this flow. It's this you know, it's that feeling, you know, that I had when that Deepwater Horizon was just sitting in the corner of the CNN screen.
Yes.
Remember when it was leaked? It's just there. And it's just like, well, what am I supposed to do? Did I be upset about it? Get used to it? Worry? You know, this sense of news as just this stuff that comes at you. And rather than digesting it, most of our cable news shows, they just have these opinions about it.
Right.
And if everybody has an opinion and every blogger has an opinion, then I guess all the opinions are kind of the same and nothing really matters and you kind of throw up your arms. You know, that's definitely what happens to most of us, and the internet just makes it worse. But there is, and I guess what I'm calling for in this book is for people to take the time to actually try to, if not comprehend what's going on, at least, you know, consider it. You know, to not always treat everything like this flow and this stream, but to sit with something and contemplate as individuals, as small groups, to realize it's okay to bite off a little piece and try to actually understand it and generalize from it, you know, rather than somehow stay aware of everything all the time. Because then, you know, every shark attack, every time, you know, Britney Spears pops a zit, it's going to have the same weight as, you know, when Iran is getting a nuclear weapon.
Is there, and I want to go back to something that you mentioned, following up on what you just said, but going back to something you mentioned a moment ago about this of being the fact that we are living very much in the moment and we don't have an eye to the future. And how much of that do you think comes from because we don't have a good grasp or a sense anymore of technologically where that's going to bring us? It seems like there's always something around. Technology is constantly changing. It's this gadget, it's that gadget, it's this thing, it's that thing that has these fundamental impacts on our lives, on our working lives, on our social lives, on our cultural lives, and that we don't know what the next thing is. And because of that, we say, all right, we almost have to just worry about what is happening right now.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I think that the kind of the way out of that is, you know, is for people to take back their own time. In other words, that you end up kind of in that victimized, almost passive relationship to all this stuff until you say, well, look, I'm actually a human being, you know, and human beings have all of these kind of almost time signatures to us that our machines don't. You know, I was doing research into, you know, biological clocks and circadian rhythms, and there's so many things about human beings living in time that we're just beginning to understand. And as we understand them, as we live really in harmony with them, if we realize something as simple that, you know, the lunar calendar, the 28-day cycle, has sort of four different weeks within it when a different neurotransmitter dominates the brain, you know, so that we have a week where we're sort of willing to make more friends, we have a week when we're better to work, we have a week when we can understand things better, that as we get sort of more in tune, I don't mean to sound, you know, new agey, but if anything, a little more scientific, you know, as we get in tune with how our bodies and minds work, you know, we can kind of be on home turf, you know, and not sort of flung about so much by, you know, the whims of media or the whims of our technologies.
I love that point because we know, our body knows, right? I mean, we're all different. We all have different, some of us are, you know, higher energy, lower energy, whatever the case may be. But we know what the pace is, and we know when we're overdoing it, and we're just, you know, not doing enough, and where that becomes the barometer of how we digest things.
Right. And, you know, and what the industrial age didn't do to us with, you know, shift labor and time is money and trying to work by the hour instead of by the piece, you know, the digital age does even further. You know, but I think that's the irony here, is that what we're doing is taking all these digital tools and just amplifying all the kind of the priorities of the industrial age. Faster, more, you know, whether we're doing it to our stock market with new algorithmic derivatives or whether we're doing it to ourselves with new always-on work ethics, we're taking a value system that we really don't have to bring with us from that past age into this one.
Because there's nothing better than a nap.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, or just
and we can use that as a metaphor for anything, of just taking a moment out of what we're doing. But, you know, let's face it, that Saturday nap, there's nothing like that.
I know, and for more and more of us, you know, it's the thing of the past. I mean, that's sort of why, you know, the most radical thing about having written this book is that I wrote a book at all. You know, think someone's actually going to have 4 or 5 hours to sit down with a book?
Yeah.
That's wish fulfillment when you buy one of these things.
but in the end, when they've taken that time to read it, you hope they get what out of that?
Well, what I hope that they get more than anything else is that they have kind of seized authority over their time, you know, and they've seized authority over their consciousness, that they're allowed to focus on something, that they're allowed to have a kind of a nice, direct, you know, a linear experience of something, you know, that it doesn't have to be either in 3D or coming at them with lasers, that they don't need to be doing 9 things at once, that they don't need to know from the outset how are they going to make money from this thing, that they can actually, you know, use the time of their life for their own life.
So you actually have a life.
Yeah, remember that?
And here's what I find so interesting about your book, and I love the book, by the way. You're a great writer, and this is it. Really, you have your finger on something that's so important here. But this is what I don't understand. We all complain about it, but why do we become beholden to it, and why do we allow it to happen? And we're more engaged in what the next thing is. Because, and I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say we all complain about it. I mean, I think that many of us complain that we're going in too many directions, and yet we have that power to stop and to do something about it, and we don't.
I mean, I think it's two things. One, or most simply, it's just the way compulsive behavior works. You know, all of these devices are like little slot machines. You know, you compulsively check your email 5 times a day, and then once there's like one little good tidbit. It's kind of like the 5 quarters that pop out of that one-armed bandit that just keep you going back for a little bit more. And the other thing, I'm sorry to say, for me anyway, it has to do with career and money and work. It's not the technology that's doing it so much as the people on the other side of the technology who will be disappointed or angry if we haven't responded or if we're not up. You know, people who will look at us funny at a party if we haven't seen that latest ridiculous YouTube viral video. Or the boss who will be angry if we say, well, no, I didn't check my email until in the morning when I got to work. I was supposed to be checking it at night before I went to sleep. Give me a break. You know, and it's very hard to say no in these situations.
And just because we have the technology doesn't mean we have to use it.
Right. But, I mean, it's easier said than done.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating book, and again, it's extremely well written and just thought provoking. It's published by Current. It's called Present Shock: When Everything Happens Now. Douglas Rushkoff, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I wish you all the luck in the world with this.
Great pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much for what you do.
Thank you very much. Right back to you. Again, the name of the book, Present Shock: When Everything Happens Now. It's published by Current. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.